The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends, David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
I keep on falling in and I love.
At the age of 14, Alicia Keys was offered a recording contract, a deal from Columbia Records that came along with a baby grand piano. That was nearly three decades ago. Since then, she's won 16 Grammys for songs that might give you the feeling of classic pop from the 60s and 70s, along with the R&B and hip-hop of our own time. In 2022, a recording industry group named her the number one R&B artist of the millennium. Keys is also very much the voice of New York City. Empire State of Mind, which she recorded with Jay-Z, has become the city's unofficial anthem, with all due respect to Frank Sinatra. And even her sense of humor struck me as quintessential New York.
We're recording and he said that the level looks fantastic. It's gonna be the most phenomenal level you ever had.
She's just a girl and she's on fire.
I was talking with Alicia Keys about Hell's Kitchen. It's a musical that incorporates her songs to tell a story about a teenager growing up in that neighborhood of Manhattan near Times Square. The show ran first at the Public Theater, and it's now in previews for Broadway. I've got to ask you, you're opening soon. Are you nervous as hell?
You know, I don't feel nervous. I feel really, really excited. Hell's Kitchen has been such a moment in the making for so long that I'm in awe. I'm in awe of the process. I'm in awe of how it's all coming together. I'm in awe of how people are responding to it so much. I'm in love with the cast. I'm in love with our team. And I just feel like it's surrounded by the best energy. And I just feel really safe and good.
Can you pin down how long it's been in the making in your mind from first conception to right now delivering the baby?
I'm going for 13 years. Because I know it was before my first son was born. And then I know that Chris and I, the book writer, Chris Diaz, we talk often about that even when Egypt was very, very little, like just born, we were talking through the concept and how we want to develop the characters and all of these things. So,
and what was the original idea? What was the original impetus to do that? You had to have a huge career as a singer, as a songwriter, as a performer. And this is something entirely different, even though I know you love musicals in general. But for you to do this on an autobiographical basis, to make your life the centerpiece of this work, how did that begin?
Well, first, I do want to say that this isn't autobiographical. I think that's important to say, because I think a lot of people think autobiographical and they think quite literal, mm-hmm. like every single piece. But is definitely based on the experiences that I had growing up in New York. And so in that way, it's very, very real. It's very authentic. It's very genuine. And so that was a bit of the impetus of like, why is this important to me? And why I felt motivated and eager to create something that really reflected the level of diversity that I've been blessed to grow up with. And for also it to be set in Manhattan Plaza, which is the building that I grew up in and is a quite unique building because it's a subsidized rent-controlled living for artists who, as we know, oftentimes there's months they go without work or there's times when you have more work. And, you know, it's a fluctuating lifestyle. And my mother would have never been able to raise me in the city if we hadn't lived there.
Did you find the 3-4 minute record, the song form, limiting in some way and you wanted to break out of it and do something larger on the screen? Did you see things on stage that you thought, oh, this, I like this form. This could really fit for me. This could work for something called Hell's Kitchen and based at least on my own story.
I love songwriting, and it's such a beautiful way to capture a moment, an emotion, a special feeling. But, you know, I do also love performance. And my mother, she was born in Toledo, Ohio. She's the quintessential New York story, I like to say. She was born in Toledo, Ohio, and moved to New York City to follow her dreams of dancing and acting. She went to NYU, and that was how she got here. That was why I was born here. That's the reason why, la, la, la. So I think that because of that, and because of her love of acting and her love of theater specifically, I was really introduced to the theater world from a very young age. You know, I remember we would stand on the like lower price ticket line, the TKS line, and everybody be there and you get your tickets and you go to the show. And I was able to really see different worlds, different creative experiences from a young age. And like, I'll never forget seeing Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk. That was the first time I felt, whoa. One, I see myself up there, or I feel rhythm, I feel dance, I feel power, I feel street, I feel, you know, these different New York experiences. And so I was very attracted to that. And so now as I look back at it, it's so thrilling to be able to merge two worlds together, this kind of contemporary music world with this musical theater world.
Talk to me about the neighborhood. The show is called Hell's Kitchen, and it's, of course, it's cheek by jowl with what we think of in our imaginations and in reality of the Great White Way, Broadway.
Right. And,
exactly. So talk to me about that side-by-sideness that you grew up with. You grew up in the middle of. You're growing up in Manhattan Plaza in Hell's Kitchen. What was the Hell's Kitchen of your childhood and adolescence, and how did it coexist with this street of dreams, this Broadway that you were so taken with, and that becomes the subject also of your show?
You're so right. And, you know, Hell's Kitchen, when I was growing up, was literally perfectly described in that name. Like, you know, and those who lived or walked the streets of Hell's Kitchen, I always like to say that it was the place of the have-nots. Like, it was the place where everyone who kind of didn't belong anywhere accumulated. Prostitutes, drug dealers, pimps, you know, X-rated theaters, you know, all kinds of grimy, Hell's Kitchen-esque vibe was all up in there. And so I think that in a lot of ways, being so close to that reality all the time, it really hardened me. It really kind of gave me a certain grit and definitely a certain way to protect myself. And I also think, to your point, there was this unique balance between that grime and then the potential of Broadway.
You started playing the piano, I think, at 7 years old. When did the dream of doing it as a real performer, as a professional, enter into your mind? 7 and a half?
Probably 4, because
even before you sat down at the keys.
Yeah, because I remember really being introduced to music through my very first kindergarten teacher. She was one of those people that, even to this day, she's still alive. And, you know, she was always had some scheme up her sleeve. She was going to get us to sing at the this place and get us to perform at the that place. And, you know, we always kind of had to, okay. And I think that that was a wonderful experience for me to try things that was quite nerve-wracking. But the minute I opened my mouth, I learned this song and I sang. I just felt something that I was like, this is something that takes away all the nerves, all the fear, all the things that get in our way.
Do you remember what you were singing at that point?
I do. It was Somewhere Over the Rainbow. It was for The Wizard of Oz. It was like the quintessential song that would open your mind like that. You know, it's the song we just released for Hell's Kitchen called Kaleidoscope is very much this somewhere over the rainbow kind of feeling of, you know, your mind opening and realizing that there's more for you out there in the world.
Kaleido, light, 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 kaleidoscope. Tonight is shining bright, you know.
This is really about a life of a young girl in her 17th year and how she is trying to find her way out from under everybody's expectations, everybody's demands, everybody's, you know, weighted things that end up on all of our shoulders. Mm. Because people, really, they want to protect us, but they, in a lot of ways, stifle us. And so she's in that very critical time in her life. She's looking for more. She's feeling quite rebellious. She doesn't want to just be told what to do and just, you know, be treated as a little girl. She really is looking for her muse.
So your main character is 17 years old, and she's named?
Allie.
Which
she's named
were.
Allie. And some people call me Allie, but not many.
Not even then?
Nope. That's a very special reserved name for only the very, 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 very most intimate to me. So people really didn't call me that. They call me Alicia. They call me right. Lello. I had another nickname, right. Lello.
Nights like this never want to finish. Don't wait for the end, let's start a beginning. Better to be alive than just to be living.
So her name is Allie. And she's 17. She's really looking for her muse, and she finds a woman who is named Miss Liza Jane, and she ends up being quite the mentor for her. She opens her universe to the craft of piano playing, actually. Mm-hmm. And so she's a skilled, beautiful classical pianist. And so when she hears her in the Ellington Room, which is this kind of multi-purpose room in Manhattan Plaza that really exists, she's blown away, and she feels like she's found what maybe's been calling her. Her mother's raising her as a single mother, and she is really doing everything she possibly can to hope that she could escape all the traps her mom, Jersey, played by Shoshana Bean, has had to endure.
Has your mom been able to see the show?
Yes, she has.
I want to hear all about that. How did she react moment by moment? Did you sit with her?
Of course. Yeah. First of all, she's at the Public. While Hell's Kitchen was at the Public, she went at least 2 times a week. And she is the world's best audience member, no question. She's going to scream. She's going to yell. She's going to ooh. She's going to ah. She's going to sing as if she never saw it before.
It must also have been a deeply emotional, fascinating thing to cast someone to play the character that is essentially you. Tell me about...
You're going to stop that. I told you it's not autobiographical,
yeah,
and you're not going to keep saying that.
Yeah, I know. But on the other hand, you keep giving it away, saying how autobiographical it is, but we won't argue. Tell me about casting this
Allie.
Young actress. Tell me her name. Tell me who she is, and what was it like to encounter her, you?
Yes. Okay. Well,
or sort of you.
You know what?
How about sort of
David?
You?
David.
Yeah.
So Allie is played by Malia Joy Moon. Mm. And she is a 21-year-old, what I would like to say, will be a breakout star, especially of this season. And just period. This is the beginning of her entire creative, you know, artistic experience. And so to find Allie really took quite a lot, because you need to not only be an exceptional dancer, an exceptional, exceptional actor, and quite nuanced, because she carries the entire show, and the way that Chris Diaz wrote the show, she breaks the fourth wall the entire show. So you are actually kind of her best friend. So the acting ability has to be very natural and developed in a special way. And then she has to have a killer voice for some really, really quite difficult songs. And so she's a triple threat. And And it's not, and wait, the hardest part, I'll tell you the hardest part. You might find people who act, you might find people who dance, you might find people who sing, you might find people who do all three. But to then have the energy of a true New Yorker who grew up in Hell's Kitchen and Harlem and have that kind of grit to you, that's the hardest part. Because you can't teach that.
What was the, was it an audition process or did you go to see people perform around town? How did it work?
Yeah, it was an audition process. We have a tremendous casting agency, and they were able to bring forth a lot of different, different options. I've definitely been notoriously hard on everybody because it really has to resonate and feel pure. And so we auditioned a couple of different people, and then all of a sudden, Malia kind of showed up, and we were like, She would have this tenderness and this ability to tap into these emotional places that felt really sincere.
Now, any number of the songs in the show are songs that you've recorded and made hits, gigantic hits in the past, but there's also, I think, four new songs?
Yes, there are new songs, and it's been really, it's been great to kind of see what works in regards to the songs that you might be familiar with. It's also been wonderful to see what works with songs that have been in my catalog but are not the quote-unquote gigantic hits. Mm-hmm. And there's a really special way to connect with them. And in some ways, I feel, man, these songs must have been written for this. Hey, I love our secret meeting on the fifth floor staircase. I'm gonna give you this letter
of all the things I can't say. Want you to be my first, my last, my last. Talk to me a little bit about songwriting, something that you've been doing since you're quite, quite young. I think maybe 11 years old was the first time you were writing songs?
Yeah, I think you're right. 11, yes.
How has that process changed for you over time?
Surely I've definitely gotten more accustomed to how it kind of happens. At first, mostly I was writing out of pain or passion or an experience or things like that. And that's really how I always write. Mm-hmm. So that hasn't changed too much, but I do think that with growing, I learned how to just create the container for what wants to be held. And then also recognizing that through that creation, sometimes there's different ways it comes about. If anything has changed, it's that I realize that I never know how it's going to happen, ever, never.
Well, take a song, an early song like Fallen, which I think is also in the show.
It is. It's really cool the way we put it in there. It's totally unexpected. You've never heard it sung like this before.
How did it come about?
Like the song itself.
Yeah.
The song itself was really written. I remember writing it in my first car, which was a Mazda 626. And at the time I was living in Harlem, and I was also going back to my mother's house because she had the piano. And I would go to my mother's house to play the piano, but I wasn't really living there anymore. And I remember feeling kind of frustrated about a very early relationship I was in. And it was like, sometimes it was so good, and then we'd be like arguing and be frustrated, and it was annoying, and then I didn't get it. And then we were like, what was happening? And I remember being in my car, like feeling that back and forth and back and forth. And I remember singing this kind of hook thingy, mm-hmm. something. I was doing something, something, and I was recording it in my phone or my voice notes. And then I got to my mother's house, and I sat at the piano, and I kind of played these basic chords. And somehow between there and there and there, all of that emotion and feeling kind of revealed itself in this song.
I'm talking with Alicia Keys, the songwriter and performer, and we'll continue in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off.
Hi, I'm Alexis Ohanian. You may know me as one of the co-founders of Reddit, but more recently, a large part of my identity is being a father to my wonderful daughters. In my podcast, Business Dad, I hope to open the conversation about working parents a bit. You'll get to hear from a wide range of business dads, from Rainn Wilson and Guy Raz to Todd Carmichael and Shane Battier, to find out how they balance being a dad with a successful career. Business Dad is available now, so be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I've been speaking with Alicia Keys, one of the top R&B singers of our time. She's got a huge string of hits and Grammy Awards, and now a musical called Hell's Kitchen, and it's just opened in previews. Hell's Kitchen is loosely based on Keys' own life experiences. It's about a teenage girl named Allie growing up in the gritty New York of the 1980s, falling in love with music and wanting to get out into the world. She's got a love interest, but the crucial relationship in the show is between the girl and her protective mother. Keys herself grew up early. She had a record deal and had already been struggling with the music industry while she was still in her teens. Now, you are so committed. You've been so devoted to this pursuit for such a long time. And at the same time, I think I'm getting this right, you really seriously considered getting out of the music business. There was a time that you were burned out. You booked a trip to Egypt, I think it was, only after you'd run a full marathon in Greece. What was happening with you? You had, God only knows, you had made it. Now you're trying to think about going out the back door.
You know, I don't know if I ever felt like I was going to not be a part of music. But I definitely, for sure, experienced a very, critical time to recognize how much you have to protect your spirit. And whether you're in music or whether you're a doctor or whether you're a hedge fund person, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're in college, you have to protect your spirit. And the world won't do it for you. They really won't. And a lot of times we're out here chasing what we think is success or what we think is a dream or whatever it is that we want to achieve. And oftentimes we're forgetting about how to continue to be a whole human being and a whole person. And at the time that you're referring to, I was so eager to be successful. I was so eager to, you know, you only get one shot at a dream. So here it is. And you see it right in front of you and you get all these opportunities and you're running after them and you say, I could do this and I could do that and I could also do that. And sure, I could do that. But I didn't really get any sleep, but I could still do it because maybe tomorrow they won't ask me again. And you have all these feelings of like fear and lack that you won't ever have the chance to do these things again. And so it depletes you. And so at that point, I was realizing that I lost a part of myself, or I had never found it yet, and I needed to slow down. Since then, I've messed it up 100,000 times more. I had no boundaries. I still didn't create space. I had people that didn't have my best interests in my world. But slowly but surely, you start to realize, you have to take control of your life.
But you've talked sometimes about the loss of what you've called sweet anonymity. And yet, there you are, halftime at the Super Bowl. You're on concert stages. You're about to
open a big show. What is that like to lose the gray zone pretty much forever? I don't know how you get that back.
You know, I feel like I have found a good balance. You know, I think that a lot of times I realize that it's also where you go. You know, when if I go upstate and take a hike among the trees, you know, there's a few other people on the trail and I'm just doing my thing and everybody's just trying to get
so
to the top of the mountain.
You're a New York girl who believes in trees?
I do.
Oh, man.
Not in the beginning. I was like, what? What do you mean trees? I only know cement, concrete. No. And I hated camp. My mother would send me to camp and I'd be like, ugh.
Trees?
I don't like the bugs, the trees,
I'm
the grass.
I'm with you.
But now I realize, wow, you know, you're missing out if you're not touching the grass or seeing some trees or seeing some nature. Like, that's part of how you keep on hold on to your soul and your spirit, too.
I have to ask you about this. There was a song that came out called Thunder on the Mountain by Mr. Dylan. And all of a sudden, the lyrics are, I was thinking about, I won't do the voice, I'll spare you. I was thinking about Alicia Keys, couldn't keep from crying when she was born in Hell's Kitchen, and so on and so forth.
I was thinking about Alicia Keys, couldn't keep from crying when she was born in Hell's Kitchen. I was living down the line. I'm wondering where in the world Alicia Keys could be.
How did you hear that? And how did you react?
You know, the craziest part is that the person who told me about Bob Dylan writing a song with my name in it and Hell's Kitchen, he had a premonition of this musical that was John Mayer. And he was like, did you know that Bob Dylan wrote a song with your name in it about you? And I was like, what? What are you talking about? I had no idea because he was so early, you know, to it that it hadn't made its way to me yet.
Thunder on the mountain, rolling like a drum, gonna sleep over there.
And so, of course, then I'm in shock.
Did you meet?
So I'm like, I felt like we couldn't meet. I was like, there's no way we could meet. Like, if you wrote that amazing song and put me in it, I just feel like I just need to forever see you from afar and just be in awe of the greatness. So we actually didn't. We didn't.
Now, it's a good thing you really stuck through that hard time that you were describing earlier, because fast on its heels came tracks on Jay-Z's album Empire State of Mind, which came out in 2009. A little bit about that collaboration. You've had so many amazing collaborations. That may be the most famous single to come out of a collaboration. What was that like? What's that working process like?
Well, I think what was unique about that process is I was right at the precipice of making a lot of changes in my life. And, you know, sometimes there's different relationships that you have and you hold on to. And, you know, you don't know how to move from them. But during this process, I remember hearing from somebody else that Jay-Z was really trying to make sure I heard this song. And I'm like, what song? I never heard the song. And so he was saying that he was going through all the channels, all the professional channels and all the things to get me the song. And like nobody was answering him back. Like nobody was getting back to him. And so he started to think of like, well, who else can I call? Like
whoa, maybe
I
nobody should call. Nobody was returning his calls?
I don't know why, or it was just have no idea. But like I said, there were some needs for some change, and I was just on the precipice of kind of learning that.
Heads were going to roll.
I mean, shouldn't I at least know about something coming from a esteemed, you know, friend? You know what I mean? So, anyway. Of course, then I was like, are you kidding me? Let me come see you and let me listen to what it is. And I remember sitting in the room with him and he had kind of the very bare bones of the song. But immediately you could feel this energy and this great, like uplifting triumph in this, in the music and the song, and of course about our city, you know. But funny enough, creating that song was definitely not kind of normal. Normal to me, because I'm a kind of a true school creator where I really like to be in the room with people that I work with, that I'm creating with. I'm cutting the bass lines and I'm playing the Moog parts, and I'm, you know, we're putting it all together, and we're together.
Old school.
If we're going to write together, we're going to be in the same room, we're going to be like feeling the whatever, and we're going to like create it. I really like that the best. And in this case, he was kind of on one side of the planet, I was on another side of the planet, and we had
and
to get it done.
And you're sending files back and forth.
Sharing across files. Yeah. And that was one of my first experiences kind of doing it like that, which is why there's also quite a funny story that came from it, that I cut the first vocals in L.A. and I sent it to him. And he asked me to redo it.
Excuse me?
It was a good idea because I was sick. I was trying to get it done because he was on deadline.
Did you have laryngitis or something?
I didn't have laryngitis, but I had like a cold. And so you could hear it in my nose. Uh-huh. It sounded a little nasally. And it was just like, it just wasn't exactly right. But I just wanted to deliver.
Now, we've all seen, read books, seen movies, heard about the bad old days of the music business. And musicians take piano lessons, they take singing lessons, they have all kinds of apprenticeships. But usually they're not trained in business. But sooner or later, if you get as big as you are, or Jay-Z, or whoever, you encounter business and the stakes are high. What's the music business like now, and what do you have to watch out for?
Man, the music
Let the record
business.
Show Alicia Keys just went.
The music business is one of the most corrupt businesses, period. It's been that way since it started, since inception. You know, it's like, it's definitely, you know, you'll see Fortune 500 companies and, you know, really experience different businesses that are set up as businesses should be. And you can see plainly the difference in the music business, and those businesses are baffling. Like, if I have my music lawyer look at something and then I have a traditional business lawyer look at it, they will not understand why the deal is done the way it's done. They're like, why? This doesn't make any sense. So still to this day, it's a pennies business. You know, people get pennies on the dollar.
From streaming especially?
From everything. Mm-hmm. From, you know, yes, is it now even more of a smaller division? Yes, but even when records or CDs or, you know, things like that were more popular, you're still getting only a small percentage on the dollar. You're going to get maybe 17%. Even as an artist, when you have managers or business managers or, you know, all of them, they try to take 20% and 15% and 25%, and they'll take it on gross, not even on net.
Right.
So it's like, it's dangerous, and you don't know these things at first, right? You're just coming off of the street, and this is an opportunity, and somebody offered you whatever, 100,000, 200,000.
And you're thrilled.
And you're like, yes, this is great. And you don't realize you're going to spend your whole life trying to get it back.
You feel like you've gotten screwed over time?
You know, I feel that I have definitely had my share of screwings, for
mm-hmm.
sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like I have also been able to, because I'm the writer and because I'm the producer and because I'm also, you know, because I do so many sides of the creative process, it's definitely been more favorable for me. And because I've fortunately learned relatively quickly that a lot of these, you know, deals are what you create. You don't have to take a standard deal from anybody.
Right.
And so I feel like I've ended up in a place that actually is where it should be.
A lot has changed because of streaming. We've long ago, for the most part, the album unit has shifted over to the song unit in the way people consume music. Do you feel that influence yourself about the way you listen or the way you create?
I mean, I still really love creating whole projects, which is another reason why I think maybe Hell's Kitchen feels so good, is because it gets to really be a whole project. That's a little bit different now in the music industry. You know, before we had a Stevie Wonder that could create a songs in a key of life that would have so much storytelling, and it would all be united all together and you cohesive. Yeah, you had to listen to the entire thing and to really get the whole message. Now there is much more of a short term mentality, and people are kind of, you know, they don't even really want to hear a song longer than 2 minutes at this point, because we're in a TikTok generation and we're in a really more short content. They call it snackable content, and people want that.
Right. Now, I believe that your husband is not a fan of musicals and that your goal was to create a musical that even he would like. So has he seen it? And have you gone over the bar?
He gives his thumbs up. There's been times in the past where I say, baby, let's go to Broadway and let's watch X show, X musical or whatever. And he's kind of like, I mean, I'll go with you because I love you, but I have to like be shaking him the whole time. Are you paying attention? Are you listening?
He's falling asleep.
He's falling asleep. I'm like, wake up. So he really loves this piece. And not just because he's my husband, but because he really feels like there's a place of connection. No matter what age you are, no matter what style of music you like, there's something here that really engages you and captures you. And he says, man, you did it. Like, how did you do it? You did it.
I wouldn't put that on the marquee. My husband even likes this.
And your husband might too.
There you go. There you go. Alicia Keys, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, David. Great talking to you. Thank you for some very thought-provoking questions. I appreciate it. It's like this, they belong
in a kiss. R&B superstar Alicia Keys. She created the musical Hell's Kitchen with a book by Christopher Diaz, and it's in previews on Broadway at the Schubert Theater. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and in a moment, we'll hear from one of the musicians who helped Beyoncé go country, Rhiannon Giddens. Stick around.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Alexis Ohanian. You may know me as one of the co-founders of Reddit, but more recently, a large part of my identity is being a father to my wonderful daughters. In my podcast, Business Dad, I hope to open the conversation about working parents a bit. You'll get to hear from a wide range of business dads, from Rainn Wilson and Guy Raz to Todd Carmichael and Shane Battier, to find out how they balance being a dad with a successful career. Business Dad is available now, so be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
This ain't Texas. Ain't no hold 'em.
The number one country song in America for more than 5 weeks is Texas Hold'em by Beyoncé. It's from her new album of country songs, and accompanying her on banjo and viola is Rhiannon Giddens, who's been thinking for a long time about the black roots of country music. Giddens, who I just saw on stage at the Beacon Theater here in New York, became a star in the Americana world, working first with the Carolina Chocolate Drops and then as a solo artist.
Ruby, honey, are you mad at your man?
But Giddens is not a fan of genre, the categories we love to stuff music into. She's incredibly expansive. All in all, she's received Grammy Awards, a MacArthur Fellowship, and last year, Giddens shared a Pulitzer Prize for the opera called Omar. We spoke a few years back when her album There Is No Other had just come out. Her collaborator, Francesco Turisi, joined us as well on percussion and accordion. And they started off with the folk song called Wayfaring Stranger.
Can I have your C? Isn't "and the banjo tuned to the accordion" the beginning of a joke? Some sort.
Rhiannon, the banjo is at the heart of your work, and there's a whole tradition that you help bring to our attention, bring back to our attention. And I think if you had asked almost anyone about the banjo, anyone who wasn't an expert or a musicologist, they would have said that the banjo is something played by white people, hillbillies, to use the old term. What were we missing there?
Well, the string band, and the black string band in particular, it really is at the heart of so many. Here we go with genres again, the genres of American music. And it was a widespread phenomenon, you know, that goes back to the time of slavery when black people were seen as natural musicians. They were encouraged to pick up instruments and then play for white people's dances and frolics and parties. And so you have the combination of, you know, native rhythms and modes from West Africa, from all over where people were coming from, and instruments that were coming over, like the banjo, which grew out of West African lute-type instruments. I mean,
how much of this do we have recorded?
Not any. That's the problem.
So how are you excavating the music in a way?
With dots. You know,
and
with,
does that
with
give
the
you
sheet
enough?
Music.
That must give you a very wide berth on how to play it.
Well, the thing is like there's a lot of scholarship that's been done on these early banjo tutors. They were very, very clear on how to play. This instrument, and
you keep saying this instrument. We have one on the floor here.
Sorry,
can you describe what this is? Because it's obviously not the kind of thing that you'd see Earl Scruggs play, or
yeah. The banjo that I have is a replica of. Well, it's kind of a composite of some banjos from the late 1850s. It's a wooden banjo. See, the early minstrel style banjos were all fretless. People are always surprised by this because it's fretless and they were gut string, and that's because they were that one step removed from the homemade gourd instruments that black folk would have been making on plantations or wherever, and that was the banjo first. And so they were all be playing these kind of instruments, which are wooden hoop, wooden fretboard, fretless, and it's just a deeper, more resonant sort of round, warm sound.
Rhiannon, you went to Oberlin, you studied, you had formal mm-hmm. training there,
yeah.
doing a lot of opera.
Mm-hmm.
How did you become you? How did you kind of create yourself and your sense of direction and where you would go in music, coming out of a place like Oberlin where you had had this formal training? Did you think you were going to be singing Les Somnambula or being an opera singer?
We all do, coming out of conservatory.
Right.
We're going to be the next big soprano, you know?
What happened?
I discovered folk music, and I discovered the banjo, and I also... You know, I'm very interested in doing something that is A, of service, and B, that not everybody else is doing. So I was like, gosh, there's like a million sopranos in the world who can sing as good or much better than I can,
yeah.
who can do these things and want to devote their life to opera, where I'm seeing this other thing, and I'm like, this is something I think I can make a difference in, you know? And it touches me, and it speaks to me. And so it just, it for me, it goes to show that you have to find the thing that you are meant to do, you know, and you don't know what it is always, but if you follow the thing that's speaking to you, you just don't know where it's going
to
lead you.
Well,
you know?
I hate to pound on this notion of categories, but what you just sang, is that classical music in a sense?
No. I mean, but then what, I mean...
That's what I mean.
You know, what is classical music, you know? I mean, we do on the album two arias, you know, but we do them in vernacular voice and with a sort of improv accompaniment. And it's like they live in a different realm and they touch people in a different way. But they're, you know, does it still mean that they're not an aria anymore? I mean, you know, I mean, that's kind of also the point of the record is, you know, who cares what the, and it, this is not just smashing stuff together. We're layering things on top of each other and finding where the peaks peak, because there's all these similarities between all these different things, and
right.
And it leads us to, you know, what music is doing for us as humanity, you know, because somebody was saying, well, you know, our diversity is also our strength. You're saying that we're all the same. I'm like, well, in our differences, we're the same.
Yeah.
That's the point, is that, you know, we express ourselves in different ways, but it's all coming back to these universal truths as humans. And the more that we can reject that idea that you are over there and you sound different to me, so that we're different people, and embrace that actually what I do in my culture and what you do in your culture is coming from the same heart, and therefore they should be able to work together, you know? That's more of what we're trying to say.
How does that relate to the next song that I think you're going to do? And you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation to get it exactly right.
Yes.
Pizzica di San Vito.
That's pretty good.
And means?
Pizzica is a type of dance from Puglia, which is
in southern
Puglian
Italy
region,
mm-hmm.
You know? So it's a type of tarantella, which is a very lively, I'm sure you're all familiar with the idea of that. But the particular thing about this music that a lot of people don't know about is that it was music to cure the bite of a spider. And it was, no, this is a very serious thing, actually. The idea with the pizzica is that you got bitten. They believed in the bite of the spider, tarantula, that's why it's called tarantella. And you would fall into a state of depression. And the only way to get rid of this was to trance dance, which could go on sometimes for weeks. You know, the musicians would come to your house.
So it's pre-antibiotics.
Definitely pre-antibiotic. Mind you, this was the last time observed in its full power in the 1960s. 1960s was still happening in Puglia.
Incredible. How is that tuned? How is it tuned?
C, well, right now it's in modal.
Mm-hmm.
But I have like three different tunings I use for. Non c'era da venire, non c'era da venire, non c'era da venire, e sono venuto. Solis spirito, solis spirito, solis spirito, ma non ho chiamato. Auelli, mulu vecco ti veni, mulu vecco tinchi nami dalla mano si ne va. Auelli, mulu vecco ti veni, mulu vecco tinchi nami dalla mano si ne va. Ti li capelli tu, ti li capelli tu, tu innamorato. Li vecco ti vola, li vecco ti vola, li vecco ti vola, stallo viento. Occhi co, te ci perdi l'occhi, ci dici male nuestro scatallo cuori. Occhi co, te ci perdi l'occhi, ci dici male nuestro scatallo cuori. Te li ritorno, te li ritorno di pinata piata. La compagnia va, a tanta vita va, la compagnia va sta sirinata. Ah, welli, welli.
Whoa. Amazing. Who do you think of as your audience for music like this? Or do you not think of it? Is it not worth thinking about?
I mean, you just can't. You can't think about audiences. You know, you just, I mean, that's...
Who do you see in the seats?
Well, you know, it depends on who knows about it. I mean, this is the sort of push me pull you of being a professional musician, is that if they don't hear about it, they're not going to come. You know, like, I mean, part of my mission has been trying to get the music that I play to more of the black community, for example, which is what people always ask me. So why are there only white people at your shows? Number one, there aren't only white people at my shows. There are always people of color who come. It's just a very small percentage of the overall whole. And the other thing is that the gatekeepers of like black culture are not interested in what I'm doing, you know. And this is a complaint I've heard from many, many people of color who do music that's not considered black. That's not, you know,
what
whether
is, and what does that mean? What is considered black now, and who are the gatekeepers that we're talking about?
Like, you know, like hip hop, R&B, blues, you know, well, blues, I mean, people know it's black, but like, you know, and there's black people who play it, but it's become
a largely white audience.
You know, white audience and white players, you know, as well. And jazz is one of those, it's kind of like, you know, in that kind of halfway house world, you know, and then opera. You know, there's like been, you know, there's been black people singing opera and doing writing classical music forever, you know, and it's like we're seen as sort of, you know, interlopers, and so it's very hard. I've talked to other people who have the same thing. I mean, I was talking to Tavis Smiley. I was on his show because Freedom Highway, I started that tour at Sing Sing Prison, and it was the largest black audience I've ever had, and that just like broke me in several pieces.
What was that like? Know? Tell me about that concert.
I mean, it was very intense, you know, to get like a cultural response that I'm not used to. Because
this is at Sing Sing Prison in Austin, New York, north of the city.
With the Carnegie Fountain, you know, the Carnegie Hall does this amazing program going in. And we worked with one of the prisoners on one of his songs about domestic violence. I mean, it was really intense. They were beautiful. And you just kind of...
So it wasn't just a performance. You were there for a while.
We did work. Yeah, we were there the whole day, you know. Mm-hmm. And you just look out that sea of brown faces and you think about what does that mean for, you know, when you talk about the incarceration of black men and men of color and, you know, how broken the system is. But then from a purely performance point of view, I was just like, the way that they responded to the music was different than when I have, you know, white.
How so?
I mean, it's kind of hard to explain, like, just the energy that was given back. And I didn't know the personal stories of any of them, didn't want to know, because it's just like, that wasn't the purpose of the visit, you know.
What did you play for them?
We had a full concert. I brought my full band, and we played a lot of stuff from Freedom Highway, and so it's just like I feel very strongly, like I'm starting to work with my nephew, who's a 21-year-old rapper who plays the banjo, right?
That's an unusual combination.
It is an unusual combination, and he's a heavy rapper. Like, he knows hip hop, he knows that world, and this is the way he chooses to express himself.
You're gonna record with him?
Yeah, we're gonna record.
What's his name?
His name's Justin Harrington. Amazing. Demeanor is his handle. But it's just like when you start crossing over into that generation and he's like, man, when I'm playing this stuff for my friends, they're like, what is that? That's amazing. And I'm like, exactly. It's like when people are exposed to this stuff, they're like, that's so cool. But getting there is the hurdle.
Rhiannon and Francesco, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Rhiannon Giddens. We spoke in 2019. Giddens appears on Cowboy Carter, the record by Beyoncé that just came out. It explores the black roots of country music. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for today. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, Jared Paul, and Alicia Zuckerman, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, Alex Barish, Victor Guan, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.